If I had to pick a topic in this world that I'm the most obsessed with, it would have to be friendship. Perhaps this is why it's taken me so long to do an episode on friendship and how it relates to therapy. The stakes are just so high. Well, there's another reason too, actually, which is that I did record an episode 2 years ago on exactly this topic with precisely the person I'll be speaking with today. And then the recording failed to upload to the cloud, and I spilled coffee in my computer and lost the episode forever. Anyways, I wrote my thesis on the intersection between friendship and therapy, and consider friendships my main life source, actually. It wasn't difficult for me to choose which fellow therapist I needed to speak with about this massive topic, because Valentina Calandra is someone who lives and breathes friendship in her work and private life, like no other person. The following conversation will be the most reciprocal one there has been during the time I've done these therapy talks, in the sense that rather than me interviewing Val about her view on friendships, we spur each other on in reflecting on our shared passion.
I'm Val. My pronouns are she or they. I've been working as a therapist, I guess now, like in total for 6.5 years. And yeah, friendship. In some ways, I think it's something that I've been thinking about and prioritizing my entire life. Like when I look back on my childhood, I'm like, oh, this has been something that has just always like mattered so much to me. And I've always sought out and somehow been really able to maintain really important friendships. In fact, I think my friendships have been the most important relationships in my life. And within the therapy context, like, yeah, I think it's come from a few different angles, but I think generally speaking, I've just always found that therapy is this close, intimate connection with another person, which, you know, broadly speaking, friendship is as well. And I've often had clients that I felt maybe in a different world, we could be friends, but I always thought there was lots of overlaps. And actually also have always had friendships that felt deeply therapeutic, where we would have the kinds of exchanges and connection that I was always taught only belong in the therapy room. So yeah, I think there's been kind of an overlap on both sides.
And if we zoom out a bit, how do you see the role of friendship in today's society? Is there a certain focus in these current times, or are there certain issues?
The short answer would be just like tragically underrated. I think it's the role of friendship right now. Friendship is like not just put on the back burner, but it's like not on the burner at all. And actually, I'm also happy that we had sort of recorded this episode, I think now like 2 years ago or something, and kind of glad that somehow that there was a coffee spill and it didn't work out, because now we get to do it again. Because in those 2 years, there's just been so many things I've like read and come into contact with that have built on my ideas around this. And I've read a lot about, from actually not so much a psychological perspective, but like a sociopolitical perspective on friendship and kinship, and how, yeah, it's just not at all valued because it's just not a, say, like state-sanctioned relationship, right? In the way that marriage or parenting is. These are relationships that are kind of like beneficial to the system, to a government. And then there's relationships that exist outside of that. And those are relationships that then aren't valued on a cultural level either. So I think there's something very kind of political about like how we're taught, or who we are taught to value in our lives, and who we're taught to share resources with, share time with, share housing with. It's a deeply political issue.
Yeah. So how does it impact a friendship that it is the least institutionalized relationship that we have? Because that could both be, you know, its strength and its weakness. Or how do you see that?
Yeah, it's a really good way to put it. I like that you say it's also strength and weakness, because I think it would have been my instinct there to just answer like in the ways that I think it's really harmful to a relationship to not be able to be institutionalized, right? Because institutionalized also means that you receive like direct benefits, whether those are like the valuing of a relationship, for example, that's romantic or sexual, or actual resource benefits like tax cuts when you're married or when you have children. So I think that would sort of be my instinct to think about the ways in which it harms, it's detrimental to friendships, to like non-institutionalized relationships, to not be part of it, to not be recognized by a system. But I do think it is also interesting, like when you say weaknesses, to think about it in terms of like, well, it allows loads of space for that relationship to look in whatever way it wants to look, and to maybe, yeah, maybe like be built and maintained more organically without needing to fit into the box of an institutionally sanctioned relationship.
Yeah, I'm really afraid of dishonoring bell hooks right now by paraphrasing super clumsily, but on her kind of like friendship examination, she describes it as, you know, like the playground and the initial way that we learn to love, because most people will have dysfunctional families where the love isn't super true, or where it's mixed in with some neglect and abuse and so on. And romantic relationships, the institutionalization has given it so many norms. And so friendship can be freer in a way.
This makes me want to ask you the question of where you think you learned how to love.
I think Cassandra taught me to love. My first really, really close friend who I met in fifth grade. And I just remember this platonic love as the first kind of expansive feeling of, I mean, our conversations just freed me. You know, I grew from every conversation we had. And I just remember our friendship as one long conversation. And I remember sometimes not sleeping entire nights because we had parents who allowed us sleepovers, you know, in weekdays. So we just like, we did everything together. We kind of like competed with each other as well, but in a very collaborative way, like in a super compassionate and collaborative way. So it's definitely friendship.
Yeah. I find that I was like, it's just have goosebumps and I'm really feel really moved by that. I have like two kind of main thoughts about it. One is that, yeah, I just find it incredibly beautiful. It really resonates with me. Like, I feel like my sort of, yeah, I'm going to put quotes out best friends, but because there's been many of them, but yeah, my best friends have had exactly that kind of role in my life. And that's spot on the sort of memories I have with them of just talking nonstop. This description that you gave of like, it's felt like one long conversation throughout all these years. That's really how I define, maybe that's especially my relationship with my childhood best friend. And then I think immediately of therapy, which I'm like, you know, and especially in talk therapy, what are we talking about? We're talking about a great conversation. And it makes sense to me that maybe we were then like drawn to this kind of work also because of that, right? Because that's in this like deep, wonderful conversation is where we also got to experience love and got to give love.
So how do you see the role of the friend in relation to the role of the therapist? We've spoken about an overlap and we kind of just like see it, you know, like we feel it in our work, the two of us. Yeah. It's a visceral truth to us. But, you know, to make non-therapists understand both the overlap and the differences, maybe we can speak a bit about that.
Yeah, for sure. I think I was saying in the beginning that I feel a little bit like there's this like broad definition of what happens in therapy and what happens in friendship. And I think that probably at least part of that definition is that it is like a close, intimate relationship in which, you know, we make ourselves vulnerable, obviously in therapy, maybe to different extents, but we make ourselves vulnerable. We come together, we talk about things. Sometimes we have a common goal, right? And I think in both those kinds of relationships, I think both those, like all those things can be true. And then I think a little bit that, you know, in therapy, in psychology, there's been all this language to kind of formalize things that are actually speaking to connection and friendship. Yeah. Right. So we talk about the therapeutic alliance and, you know, we've got all this exciting research that pretty much most people in the field agree on that it is the most important thing for therapeutic outcomes, which, yeah, I have some own critical thinking about that kind of research that's overly concerned with outcomes, let's say. But in any case, we can all agree that it's super important. And what are we really talking about when we're talking about therapeutic alliance or when we're talking about, you know, when it just clicks with a therapist or you choose your therapist? Well, we're just also talking about someone that you like, you know, and I've always felt for so long like this was kind of a taboo thing to admit or to say because, you know, I was really like, I think directly taught, and I'm curious if you were too, that that, you know, it's not about liking your client and it's not about liking your therapist. And it's just about if you can work well together. And I think there's something about this like intense, like distancy professionalism that I was like, what? We're like sitting here in a room together, like with our hearts wide open and our nervous system sinking, like talking about the most intense stuff. And it's supposed to be like, yeah, somehow actually far away from the kind of connection that exists in personal life. But that never made any sense to me. And I think the people I've, you know, quote unquote, worked the best with and had the best therapy with have been people that I think also felt like friends. And I think I probably felt a lot like a friend to them. So I also kind of have this belief that friendship as a part of the therapeutic relationship has its place. And maybe I'll just say quickly what I think some of the differences are, that I think for sure, you know, I think it was like Carl Rogers that said something about like, you know, therapy is like two people sitting in a room and one is more anxious than the other, you know, just quite like that. That we're just like, we're peers, you know, and I always like, yeah, I always speak in the we when I'm working and talking this way, that's like, hey, you know, when we're kind of walking down that forest path hand in hand. And I think it is probably better for, you know, for this relationship and the work if I'm less anxious than you are and I make myself less vulnerable than you make yourself. But those sometimes feel like the only differences. And, you know, I think this is also starting to change for me. I think I'm coming obviously to therapy as like, as someone that has, let's say, is likely to have like much bigger, like academic background and knowledge and, you know, yeah, information about what is helpful there. And it's of course about the client's goals rather than mine. But it somehow feels like that's less and less of a conscious process. And that I think good therapy feels less and less like it's about regurgitating what I've learned in textbooks than it's about forming a relationship that is the thing that is healing itself.
It also makes me think about, I don't think I've ever been asked the question, what makes you a good therapist? But I think I would answer, were I to receive this question, that I like so many people. Like, I really, truly like so many people. And yeah, some people see that as naivety, but I see it as a strength. I love liking and loving as much as I do. But, you know, I have also had clients where that wasn't the case, but where that also was the blocker. Like, it was such an impasse because the alliance just never felt deep, or it wasn't driving the process. So it became more manual based, almost more technical, where I was all of a sudden basing my work on tools from the textbooks. and you know, this is of course, this is something as fluffy but also as concrete in a way as maybe two frames of references that just weren't sufficiently aligned, and then also just chemistry, whatever that is. And maybe that is due to that misalignment between frames of reference, but it could also be pheromonal. I just can't imagine a therapist being very good if they're like antisocial or just kind of not into that many people.
Yeah. I also, this is like reminding me also of this quote that, like, I forgot who said it now, that it's hard to hate somebody up close. And I think that always made sense to me too, right? I think that generally I also find it really easy to like a lot of different people, and very rarely have it also just in my life that I'm like, wow, I really don't like that person. But I think so even more so in therapy, because the moment someone just opens up and you hear their story, I'm just like filled with compassion, because people's behavior makes sense, even the worst kinds of behavior. And yeah, more so just feel for them rather than feel like I want to dislike them or judge them.
Yeah, so maybe what can be a blocker for compassion is the person being unwilling to, or having really just like such a hard time expressing any kind of vulnerability, you know, even like implicitly. Because I've also had clients where they were almost like hostile towards me, you know, and there were so many layers of insecurity and self-judgment that came off as like borderline aggression. But I felt love for them because I could see the vulnerability. I just saw also the many layers on top of that vulnerability. But yeah, it's another thing if a person just doesn't express any of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And now that we're talking about it also in terms of like vulnerability, I'm thinking about how in last time we recorded this podcast, you were asking me if I think that something that makes me a good therapist is my ability to make myself vulnerable. But now I'm actually just curious to hear your answer on that.
I thought of these two therapists who just like kind of know how to cry on demand. And it's almost like they turn on like the cry button, the vulnerability button in sessions, you know, where I'm like, I kind of have a hard time believing. It's almost like they've capitalized on this ability to be moved so much so that I don't know if it's authentic. I guess I'm starting out with that comment because maybe, you know, vulnerability can also become a power move or a strategic marketing move almost in the Brené Brown sense, where there are some risks in that. I would almost say there are some neoliberal risks in that. But that being said, really trying to show up with your whole self, I think that is like the greatest gift a therapist can give. And that is a very vulnerable thing. So if that is really what we're striving for, showing up with our background, our emotional wounds, our experience, and giving a client a full 50 minutes of that type of attention, I mean, that's a healing power.
Yeah, that somehow showing up also authentically is maybe vulnerable in and of itself, right? To just like show up there and be willing to be entirely present means that sometimes you will be moved and sometimes you might cry with your client and sometimes you might have a thought about something that is like, well, I think probably every thought we have about something is informed by our like personal experience and positionality within society. And I think it feels like incredibly valuable. I feel like it's funny, this thing of it being strategic, because I think that I get that. And I think I need to like think a little bit more about it. I think the whole concept of like, you know, when we're talking about therapy, we're not talking about like something purely altruistic and like free activism or volunteer work. It's something we're getting money for. And so I think there is like this whole other conversation about the sort of ethics of capitalizing and all these like nice relationship things, right? Like now we're also talking about friendship, and is it like, you know, capitalizing on friendship of what I've also often referred to myself as, this like, you know, full-time professional friend.
Speaking of the differences between a professional friend, a therapist, and a friend, I'm also wondering if you've ever heard friendships defined as the relationship containing the most freedom. I mean, this is, I guess, a way of saying that it is the least institutionalized, but also that it is the most voluntary relationship. Mm. So I'm just wondering if we take only that and look at the differences. I don't know if you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think, first of all, just this whole part about friendship, not being institutionalized and therefore often not coming with like a whole set of expectations or rules or agreements, whether they're socially imposed or defined between the two people, three people in the friendship. I think, it's interesting because I think in this conversation, when you've mentioned this a couple times, I think slightly implying that it's also a strength, right? It also allows all this space, all this freedom, also resonates with me. I think I just sort of rarely think about it as being something positive, because I think, I see the reasons for that, but I see it mostly as like a great injustice that friendship just doesn't get to have almost these like expectations. And I think it's something that in my life, for example, I push a lot for, right? I have relationship check-ins with my friends. I have expectations that we see each other often, that we spend real close time together, that we have sleepovers together, that we cuddle, that we, you know, get to do all these things that I think are sort of often reserved for one kind of relationship, and even more often, I think, for just one person, even in someone's life. So I feel like And also even things like, rupture and repair processes that I think are often like that just happens in romance, that you get pissed off and then you have to deal with it and you know, repair and grow together and call each other out. And I'm like, well, no, I want to do that with, you know, 5-6 people in my life. So I feel like, yes, there's like this, you know, great openness and freedom of this sort of non-institutionalized relationship. And I think it feels also exciting to apply, for example, that kind of freedom to relationships that have been traditionally institutionalized, right? To have different kinds of broader relationships with romantic partners, sexual partners, with your kids, right? To be more open about the possibilities there, and then maybe kind of vice versa, give a little bit more potential for like frameworks and expectations to friendships.
Yeah, like a cross-pollination between the different types of relationships. Because maybe this is even a segue into speaking about if a therapist can be seen as a professional friend, how does that play into boundaries?
Yeah, I think sort of my first thoughts on some things like boundaries and ethics in psychology, I think now is just going to be like super informed by actually a book I read recently by Julie Tilson called Queering Therapy, where she's basically proposing this like really basic principle of being like, hey, boundaries, ethics, there are these things that we just kind of take for granted in a discipline, in a field. We absorb it, we internalize it, and we're like, this must be the truth because it's morally correct all the time. And she's like, you know, the process of queering something means actually asking the critical question of like, who came up with this set of boundaries? Who came up with this set of ethics? And who are they actually for? And I think, you know, often we find that they're probably not for the more marginalized, not for more alternative ways of practicing. So I think that's, first of all, just kind of the foundation to which I come to then think about my own boundaries and work. And yeah, I think that it feels for me like there's like, I think the one sort of boundary that might seem, I don't know, sort of like silly or menial, but the one really clear boundary for me in therapy is time. Right? We have 50 minutes. And that's like immediately creates this container that is obviously really different with every other relationship in your life. So that's sort of the immediate first thing for me. And I can maybe describe a little bit like how I think I have, let's say, queered some of the boundaries in my work while retaining them, because I think they are, of course, still important. And in fact, I think boundaries are important in any relationship now, right? I think I'm even talking about it now from this perspective of like, in therapy, there's just more boundaries than in a friendship or something, which I think might be true, but I think it's actually just about maybe a different set of boundaries. And yeah, I definitely was taught, for example, to not give my personal number to clients, but several of my clients have my personal number, you know, and in all these years of practice, I have yet to feel that that's been taken advantage of. And it just allows for like, yeah, I think it allows to make them feel that I'm here and I support them. Sometimes it's just an easier way of communicating. Like, you know, if someone's going to be late, that's kind of the best way to let someone know, call, send a text. Sometimes I have clients that, you know, doesn't happen all the time. I really don't think it's being taken advantage of, but then maybe send me something really great that happened in their lives, or send me like a funny therapy and client meme or something, you know? And so, but it never feels, doesn't never feel to me like too much, does never feel like it's being, doesn't sit inappropriately in my body, you know, it just sits like a boundary that actually feels good and right and supports everyone and always has the client's well-being in mind. I think those are kind of the main things. And I think last time actually that we had recorded this podcast, I was like in this process I was like sort of talking, I think, quite broadly about clients of mine, or maybe one in particular with whom I felt there was like this actually really strong friendship forming. And then since then, we went through this process of ending the therapy and moving into a space of being friends. So I think that's also been an interesting example of like, of trying to do this, right?
Yeah, because it also reminds me, and this was way more pertinent when I lived in Berlin and did only in-person therapy, where it seemed like, you know, most of my clients lived in the same part of the city as I did. And so there was also boundaries around that aspect of bumping into each other and going to the same concerts and so on. But then the ecosystem also resulted in me recommending my friends, therapists who I really liked, and these therapists becoming my close friends. And then me, of course, whenever I needed to host a social gathering, inviting my therapist friends and my friends who were clients of those therapists. And this has actually also happened in Denmark, and I just see therapists responding very differently. Some queering up the therapy space and some being very, very strict. You know, maybe it's because they haven't gotten into queering up the space. Maybe it's just their boundaries, because something that I'm also realizing as I'm speaking is that, you know, boundaries are so personal. That's what makes them your boundaries and what makes them effective also. You know, it's only if they're personal, or else they're just norms and shoulds, you know?
Yes.
So these different responses have to do with that. And yeah, I'm wondering also if that is something that you're now navigating differently than you did, you know, 2 years ago, for instance, or how you look at your personal space and the intermingling of the therapy space.
Yeah, I think like even this example that you gave from your own life of having recommended friends of yours to therapists that you also knew, that's like a specific thing that actually Tilson, like in the book, talks about with, especially within the queer community. She's like, you know, if you think about sort of the most extreme example, if you've got a small town, rural, where you have maybe a queer therapist, probably the only queer therapist, and how important it is then to actually, you know, let your kid, for example, go to a therapist who's also someone that, I don't know, you see in church every Sunday or the community somehow, and is like probably someone that they will see also like at, you know, the local barbecue, but is also their therapist. Because there are some communities in which it's actually not so safe to go kind of as far as possible to seek help or to seek service. So I think it's like this kind of perfect example of how, again, kind of boundaries and ethics were not designed for those who are most marginalized and probably aren't all that useful for them. And I feel that a lot within my own life too, of like this exact kind of, you know, being sort of just a few degrees apart maybe from people who are my clients or people that I refer my friends to. And I think when I kind of really peel back the layers of this, like, why do these kind of boundaries even exist? And I think a lot of it is just like literally stigma around being in therapy at all, right? Like, I remember my therapist when I was in college that she, because of what I'm sure she was taught, would just like completely ignore me, like wouldn't even make eye contact with me when I walked past her in campus, because she was just taught that's, you know, it's a breach of my confidentiality to even show that she knows me. And of course, this is something I ask actually all my clients when I have the chance to run into each other. I'm like, how would you like that to be? How would you like that to look? So just as you said, like, it's a personal conversation, right? Of what would your personal boundaries be around that? What would mine be? How can we negotiate those? But I think, yeah, I think this, like what that ethic, what that boundary is really built on of being like going to therapy is this like awful, shameful thing and nobody can know about it. And so like the fact that you might run into your therapist is terrifying. And somehow also this thing of like, you know, this person that knows so much about you that no one else in your life knows about you. And I think, you know, now also in the context of like friendships and really fostering friendships in the world, I'm like, I hope I'm not the only person that knows all of that about you. You know, I hope that you're not shrouded in shame when you're confronted with someone who you've made yourself vulnerable to. Like, I would like to live in a world in which that's not a terrifying experience. Though I recognize that, you know, now maybe it still is, which is, of course, why my clients get full agency in how that interaction looks like. But again, sort of on a more like systemic theoretical level, I'm like very kind of critical about what some of these ideas are based on, I think.
Something funny is that even though we've spent tragically little time fostering, nurturing our friendship, I still consider you a friend and someone I'd like to spend more time with. We're also, you know, in like geographically different places. But because of that, and because I consider you a very skilled, authentic therapist, I recommend you to so many of my friends. So I'm realizing now I actually need to ask you and I need to ask a friend how each of you will feel about me inviting you to a party next week where I know one of your clients will be. Because I want to, you know, I want to see you and I want to see her, obviously. And yeah, so this just is exactly an example of, of personal boundaries.
Yeah.
And I guess also how they're not just personal, but they're also situational, right? Mm. Because I might, I don't know, I haven't really made this thought experiment for myself, but I might feel fine with singing karaoke in front of one of my clients, but not another one, depending on how long we've been working together. And so, you know, if I was to be invited to a karaoke birthday where I knew one of my clients was going to show up, that would definitely be not just a personal boundary, but a situational and specific boundary I'd need to gauge.
Yeah. I feel like I usually, you know, I think my first feeling when you're speaking now is just like, it's exciting. Like, I think it's exciting to live in a world in which we're just like, at the very least, being questioning of kind of what's normal, what's okay in this situation. And then we ask people personally, and maybe we're also willing to make ourselves a little uncomfortable for like this kind of greater good of clearing these kinds of relationships. And I think for sure, it definitely depends on me, on for me, on who it is, so just as you were saying now. And maybe also like the kind of the context, right? I think like a party, that's happened to me before to a client, or really a party at a club. And I, you know, like everyone, I've been indoctrinated with the same stuff. So for sure, there's like a resistance in me, a part of me that's like, ooh, that's uncomfortable. You know, I'm supposed to be XYZ, but in a party space, maybe I'm different, or there's another part of me. And maybe it's even things as sort of seemingly superficial as like the way I'm going to be dressed in that space, or the way my makeup is going to be, or... And yeah, I think there is still sort of a very, for me at least, very unfortunately, still the fear of like my professionalism being put into question by people around me because of that, even if I am like constantly yelling about professionalism being questioned, like even just as a concept that exists, you know? So, but yeah, I mean, again, you know, I think that's just what we've all learned. And it's very much okay that there's remnants of that that are still there. So I still definitely, you know, I have resistance to these things sometimes. And of course, it happens to me to see a client and I'm the one that's like, you know, inside like, oh, shit. But I still want to be like challenged to be like, yeah, I would like for that not to necessarily be the case, or not to be afraid that anything is lost in like seeing these different versions of each other somehow. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. I also realize we've been speaking on more like a high and political level about the linking of friendship and therapy. But is there also something to be said about how you work with the therapeutic potential of friendships in your sessions? How you ask the investigative questions about how they are friends, how they do friendship?
Yeah, I think like now with this last bit of your question of how my clients, I guess, really do friendship, for sure. This is in some ways for me, I think, kind of what we can call, if we're going to be really technical about it, like a main intervention is, you know, who supports you in your life? Who do you support in your life? How do you experience love? Who do you feel loves you? How do you feel like that's lacking? How might we do something to change that? And, you know, just as in, I think this is actually quite a traditional way to view therapy, but I think that it's a relationship designed to end, at least end in a sort of therapist client context. Obviously, I am interested in sort of taking as little money as possible from someone and still be able to make them happier, to make them more, I'm starting to move away a little bit from the word functional, but to make them, let's say, more able to like operate smoothly in the society. And I think that literally the best tool we have to do that, the best resource we have to do that is other people, is friendship, love. So yeah, I'm asking about that all the time and helping people build it. And I think sometimes also in the direct way of trying to form something that, you know, as we've been talking about, kind of looks like a friendship, you know, where we have some shared vulnerability, where we laugh together, where we talk about also things that maybe we're just interested in for a moment in the session, where we are reliable, you know, we show up, we create an us space, right? A space that's just all ours, that's unique to our relationship. And it's my hope that, you know, by doing that and fostering that, that eventually people learn to do that better in their lives. I also think that sometimes even just looks like kind of challenging, maybe, you know, I think a lot of people show up to therapy. I mean, even people who don't show up to therapy, but I think a lot of people have kind of this narrative of, you know, everybody has wronged me and feel, I don't know, I suppose that people are kind of typically against them. And so might show up to therapy describing all the ways in which they see that. And I think sometimes it's also about encouraging people to see a different perspective or increase their compassion and empathy for other people so that they can engage in basically better repair processes with their friends. Because I think what often happens is they end up just kind of, canceling people, dropping people around them all the time when they're hurt by them. So I think also helping people be like, look, we can be hurt by people in friendship. And there's kind of another side to that is also, I think, another way that I hope to kind of foster like maintaining friendships more deliberately.
Yeah, I guess it's more than 11 years ago that I chose for my thesis topic to be about the therapeutic potential of friendships. And the reason for this is I was super into, you know, post-structuralist, social constructionist ways of thinking about therapy, and realized that so much of therapy is just very individualizing and secluded. So even systemic therapy and narrative therapy will have a format that doesn't look enough at the outside world. So, you know, you can have a systemic therapist and a narrative therapist, or these kind of people whose ethos are that we are our relationships, but they might, because of the way that they've been trained, still forget to focus enough on how to make that link happen between what goes on in the therapy session and what goes on in their clients' lives in the outside world. And I just see friendships as like the perfect linking. I will even say to my clients, hey, you know that confidentiality is a one-way street. I have that responsibility, but I encourage you to speak about what goes on in the therapy sessions and what I say and the insights that we arrive at to as many close ones as you want. Because I think with each, you know, retelling, there is some power in that.
Yeah.
And they are making that link happen.
Yeah, 100%. And it also just encourages people to have better friendships, right? Like, yeah. I think I wouldn't even have necessarily clocked it, but it's also something I ask my clients all the time in the next session. I'm like, you know, how did last session sit with you? Did you talk to anyone about it? Say about it, right? To just kind of, it makes that this, yeah, like deprivatize somehow the process of therapy, of connection, of healing beyond just this like two people in a room process. Yeah.
Have you ever thought about whether if a person, you know, if one of your clients turns out to be like good enough at friendship, do they even need that much therapy?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I need to hear your answer on it too afterwards. I think, you know, in some ways it's like, okay, in some ways it's like literally what I say to myself is, in I'm like, I don't think I need to even go back to therapy now, because I just feel like there are so many like deeply therapeutic relationships in my life. And I think what I would get out of therapy, I probably get out of those, probably in part because I'm also a therapist, not in the sense that, you know, therapists of course also need therapy, but I just think this kind of, you know, we were talking before about how maybe there is a whole kind of like theory and skill set and academic background that is also, of course, helpful in therapy. And that I feel like I have, plus relationships that feel also therapeutic. So it feels kind of like enough. I definitely have some clients that I think, actually, now that I think about it, I'm like, yeah, I think that most people that find their way to therapy, at least to my therapy, like lack enough meaningful, deep friendships. And I think to answer your question, I think it would be my assumption that if you do have deep, meaningful friendships, obviously this is really broad, right? I'm sure that there's many exceptions to this, but I think it does just make life a whole lot easier. And I think that, yeah, maybe I think this question is also, of course, kind of based on this like needing therapy, right? The concept of needing therapy. And I think then maybe there's still a lot of people who would want that, right? Who find it anyway still kind of beneficial to speak to someone who's on the outskirts, at least, of their life or their inner circles, or maybe who is also really different from them. They definitely also have clients that I think have good friends, but they're nothing like me or don't have my positionality in life, don't have my identities. And it feels maybe helpful for them to be kind of confronted with like the thoughts and perspective of somebody who's far away from their own reality. But generally, yeah, I think like friendship itself can be therapeutic. Yeah. What do you think?
The same. And I'm always quite ashamed to admit, especially to other therapists, how much I prioritize friendships and long, deep conversations with friends over, you know, therapy for myself. But then I also remember that so many of my friends are also therapists, and I do intervision, like peer intervision, like every week. That is also just deeply therapeutic, because obviously I have done therapy, but I haven't found like the perfect fit. And the reason for this is also, I think, that I've become friends with so many therapists that would have been my perfect therapist, but then because we became friends before, you know, I asked them whether they could take me on as a client, the friendship was all already happening. So
yeah, and I think like when someone is really in a place where they need like sort of serious, meaningful, also maybe behavioral change to happen in their lives, I feel like there is something about the process of therapy, like beyond also the relationship, right? Like the process of showing up somewhere at the same time, the reliability of that, like being given maybe some homework, some exercises, some things to put into place, paying for it, right? Like I think these things create an accountability for change. Yes. I very much wish that wasn't the case, right? I wish that we were sometimes better and at creating accountability for change in community. But, you know, there's, of course, a lot of people not just thinking about that, but doing that, I think, already very well. I mean, even just the concept of transformative justice, just like literally exactly what that is. I wish, and I think I'm, you know, very much sort of living and acting towards a future in which we create like communal and shared accountability for change, and also have personal desire for change and feel motivated to do so without kind of needing the like maybe more traditional professionalized format of therapy. And also where that change is self-determined, right? I think this is like also kind of a whole other conversation, but I think the history of like therapy is really coming from a place of like, oh, we've got people that are, you know, quote unquote sick, quote unquote dysfunctional. We need to give them some help so that they basically become more quote unquote normal, quote unquote functional. And then they can operate better in this like patriarchal, white supremacist, capitalist society. And, you know, I think when like you and I, you're like not really cool with that society at all, then it kind of raises the question of, you know, why are we kind of, yeah, how is that part of the process? Yeah.
I feel like this is the perfect way to end our conversation.
Totally. Thank you. It was so nice.
To outsiders, the ending of our conversation might seem a little abrupt. But the reason I found it so perfect was because I knew that I would get to speak with Valentina again only shortly after we recorded this episode. A conversation not about friendship, but about liberatory psychology and feminist therapy, which is the kind of realm we were venturing into in the last bit of our talk. You can watch the recording of this talk if you go into past events in our community, which you'll find at community.complicated.life. The event is called Liberatory Psychology. Also, in the community, you can find a newly opened space called Relationships, where you are so welcome and even encouraged to start conversations with other psychologically curious folks about all things relationship-related, be it couples counseling, romantic relationships, attachment styles, and of course, friendship. I hope to see you in there.